So let us continue. And so we're just talking about the Buddha's very famous last words, Vayadhammasankhara Appamadena Sampadeta. And I was just saying how significant this is and how important it is to kind of study these core teachings of the Buddha. The idea here, of course, very strongly is the idea of impermanence, unreliability, things coming to an end. Yeah. And this is very unpleasant for us as human beings, because unpleasant because we tend to hold on to things. When things come to an end, we don't really want that. We want things to last. So it goes against our wishes, against our desires, and that's why it is so hard and why it is so important. And this is one of the key aspects of the Buddhist idea of sammaditti. Sammaditti usually translated as right view, but sometimes perhaps translation can be varied. Maybe harmonious view or something like that is also an alternative way of looking at that. But I will just call it right view for now. And remember, the idea of right view is the very first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah. So if you make the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path strong, it means that the rest of the Noble Eightfold Path tends to happen as a matter of course, as a consequence. Because this is conditioned. The first factor leads to the second factor, which leads all the way through, ultimately, to the last factor. This is a conditioned process. So because of that, if the first factor is strong, everything else tends to happen as a consequence of that. So every time you remember this saying, yeah, things are impermanent, they are unreliable, they come to an end. Every time you remember that, you're actually strengthening the very basis of the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, so it's actually very useful and it's very powerful. And I think one of the most important things in Buddhism is actually to reflect more on these things that are right view, to remember these things. Every time when you read the suttas, of course, you are in a sense taking on board sammaditti, taking on board right view. But more specifically, basic things like anicca, things are unreliable. Basic things like dukkha and suffering, very closely related to the idea of anicca. The more you kind of get that, the more you reflect on that, the more clear it becomes. Everything else tends to happen as a consequence of that. But don't make it into something kind of sad or bad or anything like that. Make it into kind of a wisdom thing and think, yeah, this is true. Yeah, this is how I have to live. This is the consequences of this. It doesn't mean that, I have to become depressed or anything. It just means that I have to start living in a different way, because that is the consequence of these profound Dhamma teachings on right view. This is what the Buddha is saying here. He's reinforcing the idea of right view, reinforcing the idea, the very basis of the Noble Eightfold Path, to help us to establish the whole teaching and to get us going in our practice. And then he says, it's translated here as strive untiringly, appamadena sampadeta. Appamada is this very famous word in Pali, which is sometimes translated as diligence, as it says here, which I'm not really a fan of that translation. It means to be careful. It means to be heedful. It means to reflect properly. Yeah, is this right? Is this wrong? Am I acting rightly or not? You have kind of a reflective side to your life. You don't just do things assuming it's okay, but you reflect carefully. And when you have that heedfulness, as I say in English, that is when you tend to, you tend to be able to make the right choices in your life. And sampadeta in Pali means almost like to succeed. Yeah, succeed or to succeed through. By being heedful, by being careful with how you practice. That is what the Buddha is saying here. Be heedful, be careful. Always come back to the teaching of the Buddha. Remind yourself what really matters in life. And then you are on the right trajectory, going in the right direction. Okay. So that is the famous Buddha's last words. And then the Buddha says, the Tathagata's final passing away will be soon, 3 months from now, the Tathagata will take his final Nibbana. So it is the passing away of the Buddha. At this point, he has decided that in 3 months' time, he's going to pass away. So that is that one, the very first little paragraph there. And I said before, if you have anything you want to add or anything you want to say as we go along, please feel free to do so at any time. And the Lord said, Ananda, these saltries have burst forth into an abundance of untimely blossoms, which fell upon the Tathagata's body, sprinkling it and covering it in homage. Divine coral tree flowers fell from the sky. Divine sandalwood powder fell from the sky, sprinkling and covering the Tathagata's body in homage. Divine music and song sound from the sky in homage to the Tathagata. Never before has the Tathagata been so honored, revered, esteemed, worshipped, and adored. So, I don't know if you were here last year when I did this, but if you were, I don't know if you remember anything at this point, but actually, that last sentence there is completely wrong. Yeah, this is not what the Pali says at all. Yeah, this is the thing about the translators, especially this translator of this sutta here. He's not always all that reliable. He's this kind of old English gentleman who didn't know his Pali all that well, so he had made lots of mistakes, good-hearted and trying his best, but unfortunately hasn't always succeeded despite his good intentions. It sounds plausible that somebody might say that, but actually it's wrong. Yeah, what it actually says, the Pali says that this is not the way to honor, to revere, esteem, worship, and adore the Tathagata. That is what it says. It's almost the exact opposite, yeah, of what the translation has. This is not the right way, as the Buddha says. And suddenly, you know, if you read one of them, if you read it the way it is here, you think, yeah, I've got to go to the shrine, I've got to get flowers, I've got to kind of offer it to the Buddha and all this kind of thing. That's the obvious reading then. But if you get the opposite reading, actually you start wondering, what about all these rituals we do? Maybe we can cut down on them a little bit, yeah? It has almost the exact opposite effect on how we practice our Buddhist teachings. So what is the right way if that isn't the right way? And this is what it says. Ananda, whatever monk, nun, male or female, lay follower, dwell practicing the Dhamma properly, practicing the Dhamma in the right way according to the Dhamma, he or she honors the Tathagata, reveres and esteems him, and pays him the supreme homage. Therefore, Ananda, we will dwell practicing the Dhamma properly and practice the Dhamma way. This is how you should practice. So again, very interesting statement. When you look at Buddhist history, incredibly interesting, yeah? Because how do most people worship the Buddha? They go to the shrine, they put incense there, they bow down, they put flowers, they do Buddha pujas, all these kind of things. And the Buddha says, yeah, you know, okay, whatever, you know, but this is the wrong way of doing it, yeah? It's not bad, yeah, there's nothing bad about it, but it's obviously not the real way to honor the Buddha. If we are going to do Buddha puja, a little bit is okay. It should be part of our practice. It should be part of how we develop our mind. If we do it in that way, it's okay, because it's part of what comes afterwards. But if life kind of revolves around pujas and revolves around honoring the Buddha, then we have kind of lost the plot. We have lost what the Buddha is really on about. So this is a very important point. And you may wonder, the Buddha himself told us, don't do this. And still, this is what everybody does. Yeah, not everyone. There's some exemptions, of course. But this is how 90% of Buddhists live, yeah? Why is it that we don't follow the word of the Buddha? Why is it that we do things that the Buddha says specifically, don't do this, do this instead? Why is that? And there is a couple of reasons. First of all, practicing is more difficult, yeah? Can't we keep the 5 pieces? Oh, can't keep the 5 pieces, it's too hard, yeah? Can't drink, oh, it's terrible. And these kind of things. Actually, keeping the 5 precepts is not that hard if you really are committed to it. Everyone can do that. It doesn't as matter having people around you who kind of live in a similar way, who can support you, etc. Everybody is able to keep the five precepts if you really are committed and you persevere in your practice. So I was going to ask anyone, how many of you keep the five? But I don't want to embarrass you or anything like that. Because you're like, oh, but you remember that, yeah? This is really what the Buddha is on about. But this is one of the reasons why people prefer to burn incense. It's not because it's easier. But the other reason, which I think is probably even more profound and even more important, is because people don't know what the word of the Buddha is. They don't know the Buddha said these things, yeah? They don't ever read the suttas. Because you don't read the suttas, you haven't got a clue what the Buddha said. So you keep on burning incense, putting flowers, yeah, this is good to do, yeah? Without having a clue at all. So this is precisely the point the Buddha says why we need to go back to the suttas, why we need to take the suttas as our refuge. Because when we do that, we actually start to change our habits. We start to look at things differently. We actually start to understand what we are supposed to do and avoid those things that we are not supposed to do. So if we had more people read the suttas, we probably have less pujas, and we had more keeping the five precepts. Yeah, and what a wonderful thing that would be for the world. Yes, please.
You're mentioning about people offering incense, flowers to the Buddha Rupa.
Yeah.
But most of those people, I would say all, most of them who does that, doesn't know the suttas.
Yeah.
They don't read the suttas.
Then
on top of that, even those who learn the sutta like us, if we have a Buddha Rupa at home, and we don't do Buddha puja, or you don't offer any incense or lights or flowers, it's just a Rupa statue sitting down there, and it's so bare. Right? So, on top of that, the belief that we revere the Buddha, then we don't want to make it so bare, we buy flowers, and all those put it there, especially on the first moon and the new moon.
Okay. So, your first point, they don't read the suttas, yeah? So next time you see somebody do that, take this passage and show it to them, yeah? So this is how you get people to see the suttas. So you can, the idea is we teach people these things.
But I think all habits die hard.
They do. So don't take the oldest ones. The oldest ones, okay, let them be, yeah? If you're over a certain age, 70 or whatever, carry on in your old ways. But the youngsters, yeah, when they come 20 years old, even when they get into the 30s, yeah, we can kind of encourage them in the right way.
If that's the case, in time to come, the statue is just them. Nobody will respect the statue anymore. It's just a statue to them. They don't even review the statue and do a Buddha puja.
Sure.
Then it's just a statue lying there because it's the sutta says don't do that. And then from the generation, that young generation becomes old and to pass on to the new generation, the statue is just a stone. They were saying that. That comprises what the Christians are saying.
Okay.
It's a stone.
There's a couple of different things you can do there. The first thing is that sometimes if you have a very nice Buddha statue, it creates on its own, it creates peace and harmony in a house. That's my experience. I remember coming to a house in Singapore. I was staying with this very wealthy, very, very wealthy family. And as I came through the main door, there was this big Buddha statue right there in the entranceway, when you come in. Beautiful ancient Buddha statue, very nice. And it creates an atmosphere in the house that was absolutely astonishing. There was no flowers, no incense, nothing, just a bare Buddha statue. But when you saw that straight away, when you come into this large house, you feel, whoa, it is so peaceful, it is so beautiful. So Buddha statue can have a very powerful effect in its own right if it is well made and well done. It has the right qualities. That's point number one. Point number two, it is okay to put flowers and incense for the Buddha. Yeah? It is not a problem. My point is just that if you do that, make it part of your practice. Don't make it part of just a ritual you do that is empty of meaning that you do all the time just because you have to do that. Make it part of your practice. Bow down to the Buddha. Bow down to the Buddha is a beautiful thing to do. Yeah? It feels good.
The important thing is to know what...
Yeah.
What the meaning behind the bowing down to the Buddha.
Yeah.
Paying respect to Buddha, the meaning behind that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's statue, but it's the meaning behind that that's more important.
Exactly. Yeah, the meaning behind it, and also how you feel when you do it. Yeah, make sure you feel something. The point of bowing down and paying respect to something like the Dhamma and the Buddha is because it feels good. It feels, it makes you feel peaceful. It makes you feel happy. It makes sense of joy. Wow, what a wonderful thing it is that we have this Dhamma in the world. Yeah, helps us all to be better people. It creates a better world, all that sort of stuff. Then you're doing it in the right way. But don't do it like kind of a, okay, I've got to bow now. Okay, let me get it out of the way quickly because I've got to bow to the Buddha. Yeah, that sort of point is not, and they might as well forget about it, not bow at all. That is really what it is. Yeah, but it's a good point. I agree with you. So integrate it properly, then it becomes very useful. Same thing with chanting, yeah? If the chanting is helpful for you because it makes you feel at ease and at peace, and maybe you even understand it a bit, it's wonderful to do a bit of chanting. But don't sit there chanting for hours every day and having no idea what's going on because you think chanting has magic powers, yeah? That is the wrong way to go about the chanting practice. So. Okay. So please remember that, and also remember that because tomorrow we have the 100-year birth anniversary, is that right? Yeah, of Dr. Kesari Ramananda. And of course, he also, very important teacher here in Malaysia. I hear so many people who have been influenced by his teachings. And of course, that is how you pay your respect now after he's passed away. That's how we remember him, remember his name, is precisely by practicing what he taught. Yeah, keeping those precepts, doing those things that actually are useful in our Buddhist life. Don't make keeping the five precepts into a burden. Make it something happy. Yeah, understand the power of these things. Think of it as a way of supporting yourself and supporting the world. If you make it into a burden, it's very hard to keep them. Make it something joyful that you keep in the five precepts. If you make it joyful, it's much more easy to keep these things. Okay, so that is how to honor the Buddha. And one of the things to remember here is that the reason why the Buddha teaches, and he says that in the first paragraph there, is for us to become happy. Yeah, is to provide us with satisfaction, provide us with joy, provide us with peace. It is to help us overcome suffering. That is why the Buddha teaches these things. He doesn't teach these things merely so that we can go around worshipping him. He probably doesn't want to be worshipped. Eh? He probably feels a bit of a hassle. Oh, please, no, don't, you know, enough worship. Go, I want to just meditate, yeah? That's what the Buddha says. Why are you coming bowing down to me all the time? That's a really good monk. If you see him, oh, no, don't, please don't bow to me. Just, you know, go back, go home and meditate, yeah, instead. That's much, much better. Yeah? That is kind of nice, yeah? Because the Buddha doesn't have a sense of self. He doesn't care whether you bow down to him or not, which is kind of nice. So, and this is the thing, maybe the Buddha statue gets a bit upset as well if we bow too much, yeah? Maybe it kind of thinks, oh, enough bowing, yeah? Now, get back to the suttas. Now, that's kind of reading too much into the Buddha statue. But the purpose of a Buddha is to help us. The purpose of the Buddha is to help us resolve our problems, to become more happy. If we don't do those things that make us happy, we are wasting the opportunity. And the Buddha sees that, and the Buddha feels sad. The Buddha feels, well, I taught you all these good things, for goodness sake. Take them on board. This is what it's about. Don't just bow down all the time. Okay. That's what Ajahn Brahm says, very interesting here. Ajahn Brahm says that whenever one of his disciples, you know, whether they're monastic or lay people, whenever they get into a good state of meditation, he says it makes him so happy here. Yeah, wow, finally you're getting some real results in a meditation practice. He says, well, this is what I live for. This is what my teaching career is all about, that you guys can be happy here. Ajahn Brahm doesn't do it for himself. Yeah, he doesn't care. Actually, he'd much rather stay in his cave and just meditate, to be honest with you. You know, Ajahn Brahm has about three times as many invitations that he can possibly ever take up. So hold on to him for dear life. Once a year he comes to KL or whatever. But this is the thing. He doesn't, you know, oh, I have to go overseas again. He doesn't really want to go anywhere and teach. But he does it purely out of compassion and kindness. When he sees people getting results, it makes him very, very happy. That's what his entire teaching life is about. And, of course, the Buddha even more so. Then Subhadra approached the Lord, exchanged courtesies with him, and sat down to one side, saying, Venerable Gotama, all those ascetics and Brahmins who have orders and followings, this is Sanghas, yeah, who are teachers, well known and famous as founders of religious schools, and popularly regarded as saints, like Purana kasapa makkali gosala ajita kesa kambali pakkuda kachayana sanjaya belataputta niganta nataputta. These are the kind of standard set of various teachers in India at that time. Have they all realized the truth as they claim? Or have none of them realized it? Or have some realized it and some not? Yeah, this is the kind of question you hear all the time. Yeah, who actually knows? Who has insight? Who has an understanding of reality? These are the kind of typical kind of questions you hear. And of course, the Buddha always has a good answer on these kind of occasions. Enough, Subhadra, never mind whether all or none or some of them have realized the truth. I will teach you Dhamma, Subhadra. Listen, pay close attention, and I will speak. Yes, Lord, said Subhadra, and the Lord said. The first thing you will notice here is that the Buddha doesn't reply to the question. Yeah, it's not the kind of question that you really should reply to. So if you come, for example, if somebody asks me, and this happens all the time, Ajahn Brahm, you know, what is he? Is he arahant? Is he kind of this? Is he that? And if I tell them what I think, I'm just being stupid. Yeah, like the Buddha doesn't say anything. You see here, he kind of keeps it quiet. And it's stupid because often it just creates conflict and problems. If I say so, then perhaps if I say one thing, then perhaps you will agree. But then you go to some other person, ask them, and they will say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you know, he's like this, and they maybe contradict what I say here. And after a while, you start to become uncertain. It starts to become contradictory, and you don't really know what is going on after all. So much better just to kind of observe for yourself and then kind of gain the right faith from there. That is really the ideal way of doing things, instead of kind of answering these kind of questions. And the Buddha, same thing, he doesn't answer that question, yeah? Because he knows that probably will lead into trouble if you answer that kind of question. That's the first thing. Certain questions should never really be answered. And then he says, in whatever Dhamma and discipline, or whatever Dhamma and training, Dhamma and Vinaya, the Noble Eightfold Path is not found. No ascetic of the first, second, third kind are found there. But such ascetics can be found of the first, second, third kind in the Dhamma and Vinaya, where the Noble Eightfold Path is found. First, second, third kind, it just means the Aryas, the noble ones, the stream enterers, all the way up to arahants. So these are the people who have realized the Dhamma for themselves. Yeah, this is what this is about. So this is the Buddha's answer. Where you have the Noble Eightfold Path, that is where you have noble ones. Where you haven't got the Eightfold Path, you won't have it. You need the Noble Eightfold Path. That's the only path that leads to these things. That is what the Buddha is saying here. Haven't got the Noble Eightfold Path? Tough luck. Can't do it. And this was interesting because as I said before, I was in Indonesia quite recently. And in Indonesia, it's a bit different from Malaysia. In Indonesia, when you go to the audience, there's lots of variety of people come to these talks. And the reason is because Ajahn Brahm is so incredibly famous in Indonesia. He's kind of seriously famous over there. He is, I don't know if you heard it, but he's on the bestseller list. His books are on the bestsellers in Indonesia. It's like, you know, you have kind of Dan Brown, you know, the kind of, you have Harry Potter, yeah? But before that, you have Ajahn Brahm. He's number one, yeah? That Harry Potter is kind of small stuff compared to Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm is kind of up there. Yeah? And 90% of the people who buy Ajahn Brahm's book in Indonesia are not Buddhists. They are Muslims or Christians or Hindus or whatever else. They're not Buddhists. So because Ajahn Brahm is so famous over there, when I go there, because everybody knows that I'm connected to Ajahn Brahm, yeah? Yes, you kind of become a little bit famous because Ajahn Brahm is so famous. Yeah? And then you go on stage, you look out into the audience, and maybe a quarter or a third are not Buddhists. Yeah, a lot of them are Muslims. The women sitting there with their headscarves, yeah, kind of traditional kind of Muslim headwear. And it's quite cool. It's quite nice when this happens. And very often afterwards, when we open up for questions and answers, the Muslims will ask questions. Yeah, and some of them are very educated, very intelligent people. And some of them ask questions like, well, you know, what about, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, are we also able to attain kind of these things, awakening and things? And so what do I reply? I said, sorry, you got wrong view. There's no chance for you. Do I say that? That would be a very bad idea to say, yeah? In a country like Indonesia, where you have many different religions coming together, the Buddhists are only 0.7%. So you have to be very careful what you say as a Buddhist. Yeah, 0.7%, you kind of get, you know, you have to really be humble when you are such a small part of the population. But this is what I quote, yeah? Whoever practices the Noble Eightfold Path, don't have to be a Buddhist, don't have to be anything, really. Can be whatever, as long as you practice Noble Eightfold Path. No worries. I didn't say no worries, but I, you know. And they were so happy with that. When you give an answer like that, and you don't tell them that kind of their way is bad or anything like that, they're so pleased, yeah. Because you realize that it makes us feel included, it makes us feel part of, you know, belonging to the same family. Yeah. And I think this is so important. We need more harmony in the world. There's so much problems already. Yeah. But so you have to be careful when you answer these kind of questions. But of course, one of the things from a Buddhist point of view, one of the aspects of this is that the Buddhist path starts off with the right view. I didn't say anything about that, yeah? So I had to be a bit careful at the beginning. I said Noble Eightfold Path, I didn't really explain exactly what that means. Because if you explain what it means, it gets a little bit more controversial at that particular point. But the point is, you don't have to call yourself a Buddhist. You don't have to swear allegiance to the Buddha or anything like that to be practicing. And that's why we have Pacheka Buddhas in Buddhism. Pacheka Buddhas, people who become enlightened despite not having a Buddha to teach them, despite not really being Buddhist. So, and this is kind of one of the beautiful aspects of the Buddha's teaching, is that they have this universal aspect. It's easier to create harmony in this particular context. So, that was an example of that. Another example, when I went there, there was one Muslim woman, she asked me, well, you know, if a Muslim practices metta, loving kindness, or a Christian practices metta, or a Buddhist practices metta, is there any difference? And of course the answer is, well, if you practice it correctly in the right way, yeah, you really mean it, you really mean may all beings be well and happy, then of course there is no difference. It's exactly the same. So this kind of brings people together in a nice way. We need more of that in this world. We feel so split, you know, so much one against another one. So this is what the Buddha does here. Brings people together rather than breaks them apart. Okay, now Subhadda, in this Dhamma and Vinaya, the Noble Eightfold Path is found, and in it are found the ascetics of the first, second, third, and fourth grade. So, you know, if you come to the Dhamma that I teach, well, at least you find the Noble Eightfold Path there. Whether you find the Noble Eightfold Path with his other teachers, I'm not going to say, but, you know, this is where it is found. Okay. Let us have a quick look at the very last little paragraph here. And the Lord said to Ananda, Ananda, it may be that you will think the teacher's instruction has ceased. Now we have no teacher. It should not be seen like this, Ananda, for what I have taught and explained to you as the Dhamma and the Vinaya will, at my passing, be your teacher. Yeah, so there you are. The teacher is precisely the things that we are reading right now. That is the teacher. This is where you find the real teachings. Not Ajahn so-and-so, not Ayah so-and-so, not Sayadaw so-and-so, not Master so-and-so, not Rinpoche so-and-so. Not all these things, but the teaching of the Buddha. That is the ultimate teacher. This is what will carry on after the Buddha's passing. Will be our teacher from now on. Black on white. Okay. So that is the small extract from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And Again, I like to just make this point every time I teach, especially these kind of retreats, just to remind you where the real Buddhist teachings are found and where they are not found. So we can have this sense of anchor in the world where everything is kind of moving around and drifting here. We can come back to one thing that is relatively certain. Of course, even this, you don't really know it certain until you have insight yourself, but I would say that in all things, this is probably as far as certainty can go when it comes to religious teaching, the teaching of the Buddha. Come back to the word of the Buddha. And one of the strange things, one of the complaints I always hear when I say, read the suttas, people say often, oh no, can't understand the suttas, too difficult, too hard, yeah, too hard to understand. And there is some truth to that, and the reason why there is some truth to that is because often it is translated by people who use language which is too kind of highfalutin, too technical, too educated. Yeah, people like Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is a philosopher by trade. Yeah, if you have English as your second language, I don't know. How you are? Do many people in Malaysia have English as the first language, or is it mostly second language? Second, kind of sort of on the kind of So, but the problem is that if you don't speak English all the time in your daily life, and if you haven't got that as your first language, it's going to be very hard to read technical words like Bhikkhu Bodhi's. And for that reason, sometimes, you have to have a dictionary there and you have to have suttas over here. That gets a bit burdensome after a while. So I can understand why people say that. But actually, when you know the Pali and you know how the suttas go, actually, it is often very simple. It is very straightforward, not very hard. And very recently, that has just been released now on Sutta Central, new translations by Ajahn Sujato. Have you know Ajahn Sujato? Yeah? Has he been here? No? Not been here? Previously, yes. Okay. Long time ago. Okay. Invite him again. Yeah. But now all his translations have been released on a website called suttacentral.net. And these translations are more accessible than Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations. He has deliberately tried to use a simple language because he knows that many people who have English as a second language are reading the suttas. So deliberately used a simple language to phrase things. That's a very positive thing. The Buddha taught people from all walks of life, and that is also true now in the present day. So it should be fairly simple to understand. I find actually, what I find is so interesting when people say that, oh, it's so hard to understand the Buddha, so I prefer to listen to this teacher and that teacher because I can understand what they're saying. Yeah. But actually, sometimes that's true. Sometimes what people say is relatively simple. But if you want to understand the Dhamma fully, if you want to understand the deeper teachings of the Dhamma, in my experience, very many of these other teachers are actually not that easy to understand. Often it is ambiguous when it comes to the deeper teachings. Often it is actually, often it may even be inaccurate. I have found if I want to read something which is unambiguous and clear, and especially when it comes to the deeper aspects of the Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha are far more straightforward than the teaching of many modern teachers. So I would recommend to you, if you want the easy stuff, go to the Buddha. Yeah, the Buddha is the easy one to understand. Whereas many of these other teachers are actually more difficult. Of course, we don't always need to understand the deep teachings. Very often is all we need a little bit of a reminder to keep us going on the path. Yeah, and we can hear something very simple, some stories, a kind of a light Dhamma talk with a bit of stories and jokes and that sort of things, and just to kind of remind you of the basics. But if you want to really understand what's going on, teaching of the Buddha are the best. Yes.
I also read my own suttas, but one thing that I felt very confused is, like when I listened to the Mahaparinibbana from YouTube, and you mentioned a lot of distortion by either political issues or, like it's been a long time, And it could be distorted a lot. So how can we know?
Yeah.
Like it is straightforward, and not all the God's endeavors is very hard to believe in.
Okay, sure. That is a good point. And how do we know? And this is, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but we can know with quite a lot of certainty. And the reason we can know is basically because of how the suttas have been passed down in different lineages, different traditions. So you have the Agamas in Chinese, which are just an alternative transmission of the suttas. Those Agamas were translated mostly from the Sarvastivadin school, was also some from the Dharmaguptaka school, and these were the schools of northern India, up in Kashmir and Gandhara, which is now found in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. Those schools were established around the time of Ashoka. That's when they were established in the north of India. The same time that the Theravadan tradition was established in Sri Lanka. So that would have been about 260 years BC. Yeah, so very, not long after the Buddha, 150 years after the Buddha, quite close. All these schools started to separate. But there's good evidence for that. Inscriptional evidence, evidence from the Ashokan inscriptions, evidence from relic caskets in Sanchi, where you have the famous stupas of Sanchi. There's also scriptural evidence in some of the commentaries of the Theravadan commentaries talks about how it spread out, and all of these come together, and it's remarkable how these stories actually, when you look at the inscriptions in India and compare it to the Sri Lankan commentaries, actually it's almost exactly the same, It gives a very kind of strong sense of confidence that this must be true historical facts. So the idea that the Dhamma spread out at the time of Ashoka seems to be fairly established. But because it spread out, and it spread out into such vastly different geographical regions, if you take a ruler and you measure distance from Sri Lanka to Kashmir, about 3,000 kilometers. Yeah, it's a long way. How far is it from here to Ho Chi Minh? It's not 3,000 kilometers, it's much less than that, Even across Australia, well, that's a little bit more, but it's almost like going across Australia. It's a very, very long distance. So, but they were separated by vast geographical distances, and that is why, one of the reasons why the canon started to be shaped differently, because they weren't really reciting it together anymore. They couldn't do that. They were too far apart to really have much impact on each other. There may have been some impact, but not all that much. And then, those Sarvastivadin and Dharmaguptaka scriptures, they went with the Silk Road, because this is very close to the Silk Road when it comes to Kashmir and Gandhara, with the kind of the merchants on the Silk Road, the monks would travel with them, and then go into China, and they would enter China, and they would end up in Xi'an or something like that, and when the ancient capital of China, Luoyang or Xi'an or something like that, and then they would translate them into Chinese. And this started with a monk called Anshi Gao, who started about the second century AD, I think. But more so, it happened, some of the main translation work happened in the 4th century AD, a lot of translation work into Chinese, and even more so later on but that was most of the early stuff was translated quite early on, 4th century AD roughly, into Chinese, and it's been held in a Chinese canon ever since then. So these have been separated for 2,300 years, completely different lineages. And then you compare them now, and what do you see? You see a lot, not only a lot, sometimes it's almost verbatim exactly the same after 2,300 years. Look at the formulas for the jhanas. First and second jhana is essentially verbatim the same in the Chinese canon as it is in the Pali. Of course, you have to know both ancient Chinese, and you also have to know Pali. Not many people do know both of these things, but some people do. And then you compare, and you think, wow, how is this possible after 2,300 years? And the reason why it is possible, of course, is because the Buddhist schools have been incredibly conservative. They had tremendous faith in the Buddha. They knew that we are dealing with the most holy scriptures that are possible. We have to preserve them so carefully. So there was an inbuilt, the evidence shows us that there's a very strong inbuilt conservatism in Buddhist circles. And this is kind of, you find out this way through comparative studies. And so this is really how you know that. And so you, the very strong conservatism, and for that reason, when you read this, you can be pretty sure this is almost exactly what we have. The Mahapanibbana Sutta exists in three or four translations into Chinese. There's also a Sanskrit version of it. I think probably a Tibetan version as well. I can't remember. And then you can compare all of these things. And most of these points I'm reading out now are exactly the same in the other versions of this particular sutta. So you can you're okay, you're on safe grounds if you take this particular sutta. It is an important point. And you will find that in the academic world, there are people who will contest this. But very often, the people who will contest it are people more from the Mahayana side of things. And the reason why they will contest that is because for them, it is difficult to accept that this is the word of the Buddha, because they want their suttas to be the word of the Buddha as well. Yeah. But some of the most influential figures in the Mahayana world, the very famous Taiwanese monk Master Yin Shun, he also recognized that the agamas actually probably are the word of the Buddha. So even some of the Mahayana scholars actually are starting to understand this. If you look at it carefully, the evidence is just so strong that this must be the case. It's very hard to deny that from historical reasons. So, but I agree with you. It is a very important point.
Timer like me.
Yeah.
I don't know where to start. I don't know how to start.
Yeah.
But from meditations, I know that I have to start from sutta to really understand what is Buddhism.
Yeah.
But I'm lost.
You lost.
Because besides meditations, we don't really read. Don't know where to start, how to go about it.
Yeah.
We are not so in depth. We only the surface.
Yeah.
Maybe you can guide us in that. This is my first time.
Okay. You have come to the right place, yeah? So you're very fortunate to come exactly to the right place. This is to get you started. Don't believe everything I say. This is the first one. Be skeptical, yeah? Some of the things I say will be good. Some things I say will be, well, you can maybe not 100%. But generally speaking, I don't intentionally try to deceive you. I intentionally try to do my best. But of course, everybody makes mistakes. So remember that, first of all. But when you start out reading the sutta, it's good to have some guidance. And this is my purpose of being here, is to give you some guidance how to understand these suttas. Later on, when you start to do this on your own, it's good to use the internet. There is a lot of good talks available on the internet that explain these suttas. We have them on our website, bswa.org, which is our website in Perth. Well, Yin, you listen to those talks sometimes, is that right? Yeah. Some of you, all the time, okay, yeah. And there we have lots of sutta explanations as well, which are, and I think they are quite good. I honestly do think they are reasonably good quality here. So that is where you can get help in understanding these things. Also, I would recommend reading a little bit on your own as well. As I said before, a good place to start is in the book called In the Buddha's Words, which is an anthology, a putting together of many suttas by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is you can get advice from the more senior members of the BGF here, because they will know what I'm talking about. And it's a very nice compilation with introductions and with all of these kind of things that helps you out to understand what is going on. So when you do it in this way, you gradually start to you're already doing really well. You come here, that means that you're interested. Things will just happen from here on. It will be automatic. You will be like a robot. You will kind of go to the source and things will just happen on their own, yeah? That's a good thing, isn't it? So from now on, it will start to. Are you going to come to the meditation as well afterwards, the 5-day meditation, or just are you coming just for the suttas? Okay. You don't have to explain. I understand. That's okay. It's fine. But it's long already. Okay. Take the comment on board, Bobby, so we can kind of keep that in mind for future reference. Not enough. But what I do during the meditation retreat is I do suttas that are suitable for meditation, so that I actually teach meditation through the suttas. So if you want to learn that side of things, you should maybe come for one of those in the future, and you will learn that side of things as well. It's not, here we're pretty relaxed about the meditation, we're not really hardcore, yeah? You don't have to sit on the floor for 10 hours every day, anything like that. We do this thing very in a relaxed way, yeah? Yeah. Okay, but thank you for that question. These are all very good questions and very important questions. So I'm very glad you asked these things because these are basic but significant questions. So. Okay. Please. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think the thing there that we have to remember that Buddhism does discourage attachment in a certain way. Yeah. But remember, you cannot choose not to be attached. Yeah. Sometimes you always hear Buddha saying, "Oh, I shouldn't be attached. I have to be a good Buddhist." But it's not something you can choose. You can't just wish away attachments. Attachments are there. Yeah, they are part of what you are as a human being. It's unavoidable to have attachments. If we try to be unattached by forcing it on ourselves, it becomes a superficial kind of detachment. It's not the real detachment. It's like saying, "Oh yeah, I don't want to have anything to do with that," and you kind of close your eyes and look a different direction. But actually it doesn't really work that way. You can't have a superficial detachment. It has to come from deep inside. So don't worry so much about your attachments. They're okay. But remember that your attachments are always going to cause you suffering here. So instead of saying, "I will not be attached," you ask yourself, "What is the practice I can do so that in the long run my attachments become a little bit less?" Yeah, that is the right kind of attachment. The reason why people, I think, are concerned about this idea of not being attached is because they don't really understand what not being attached is. They feel it means not caring. They feel it means being apathetic. They feel it means, as you say, not having any passion for things, yeah? Not really caring about things. But that's not really what it means at all. It means more like a deeper sense of metta, which is more encompassing. It's larger and broader. It encompasses more. It's a different attitude towards the world and different attitudes toward yourself. So the right approach is not to say, "I will not be attached." The right approach is to say, "I can see the danger in attachment. I can see it will lead to suffering in the future if I'm not careful with this. What can I do to reduce my attachments in the long run?" And the answer is, practice the Noble Eightfold Path. Practice kindness. Practice generosity. Practice compassion. And as you do that, you gain an internal sense of freedom and liberation. You gain an internal sense of satisfaction, contentment, and joy as well in the mind. And that, because you have internal happiness, you are less reliant on external things for your happiness. It means that you are more free from the external things. When you are more free from the external things, you are less attached. When you are less attached, you have more clarity. When you have more clarity, you have more ability to help people around you, even those you're attached to. If you're too attached, you will make mistakes, because it's not about them, it's also about you. Yeah, if your son or daughter or your wife does something really strange or bad, you feel slightly embarrassed, yeah, because they're close to you. You know what I mean? Yeah? But if you are more detached and you don't have that vested interest there, if your son and daughter and wife do something bad, you don't feel embarrassed anymore. Instead you think, "Oh, what can I do to help them?" So you have less vested interest. When you have less vested interest, when you are less involved into how they are supposed to be, rather you come from more pure metta, pure compassion, then you have the ability to help them out in a much better way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm saying you don't have any choice but to be attached, yeah, because it's part of the human psyche. It's part of what it means to have a sense of self. We all have to have a sense of self. You cannot avoid being attached. So what you do instead is that you say, okay, well, let me attach to some good things as well. Let me attach to the five precepts. Let me attach to kindness. Yeah, choose your attachments wisely here. And then let go a little bit of some other attachments, like attachment to drinking alcohol or whatever it is. I'm not saying you're drinking. I'm just kind of, you know, making up some random stuff. So first of all, choose some good attachments in your life, because those good attachments will help you to be less attached. Secondly, remember, attachment decreases gradually. You cannot decide, I will not be attached. It's impossible to make such a decision. Through practice, your attachments will gradually decline all of their own. Yeah, and as you do that, gradually, you start to actually feel much better, and you have much more ability to act wisely in the world when you have less attachments than when you have more. So it's a really good thing not to be attached, you know. People think it's bad. Actually, it's incredibly good. Yeah, the most happiest people in the world are the ones who are least attached. They're the ones who have the most ability to help other people. It's really, really positive. It's one of those strange things. I mean, I have, I've had a couple of family members have been very sick with cancer for quite a while now. They're still alive, they're still going strong, but, eventually the cancer will probably get the better of them. But in a sense, that doesn't really make me very sad anymore. If it was before I was a monk, I would probably have been really upset, but now it doesn't really matter so much to me anymore. And the reason is because I feel, well, you know, this is life. Life is like this. They have lived well, they have done what they can with their life. Now I just want to encourage them in their last years or whatever it is to live well and to do the right thing. And because I have that attachment, I'm more able to support them in a good way without getting upset and negative and kind of having being traumatic for me. Less attachment is good. Yeah. Okay. It's a weird thing to think about with attachments, because I think it's one of those many areas that are often really misunderstood among Buddhists. Okay. But please, there's also, Bobby was going to have Q&A tonight as well. Is there a place where people can write down their questions or yeah, maybe get some paper and things out so people can write down. So if you feel that your question is too private or you don't feel happy with talking about it in public, you can please write it down. And we'll take that in the Q&A session this evening. So now we can continue with the next little sutta over here. And this is the Singsapa Grove Sutta. And another little sutta just by way of introduction. And this is how it goes. It's quite a well-known little sutta. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Kosambi in the Singsapa Grove. Singsapa is a kind of tree. Then the Blessed One took up a few Singsapa leaves in his hand and addressed the monks thus. What do you think, monks, bhikkhus? Which is more numerous, these few leaves that I have taken up in my hand, or those in the grove overhead? What would you say if the Buddha said that? It's pretty obvious, yeah? Venerable Sir, the leaves that the Blessed One has taken up in his hand are few, but those in the grove overhead are numerous. So too, bhikkhus, the things I have directly known but have not taught you are numerous, while the things I have taught you are few. And why, bhikkhus, have I not taught those many things? Because they are unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life, and do not lead to revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to nibbana. Therefore, I have not taught them. Here the Buddha is making the point that actually what he knows, what he has understood through his direct knowledge and understanding is actually much more than is in the suttas. The suttas is only a small part of that, like the few leaves in his hand. If you compare the few leaves in his hand compared to all the leaves in the trees overhead, wow, it's a massive difference. It's only maybe a tiny fraction of the leaves in his hand compared to the leaves overhead. So what about all those leaves overhead? What about all those things that he has realized? Would that be interesting to know? Yeah, it would be interesting, yeah. It would be really, wow. I mean, imagine the Buddha has awakened to this. He has understood, wow, that would be so interesting, yeah. But imagine how many books we would have, yeah. If we have now, the Pitaka is about that long, yeah. It's about how many volumes? 20, with the Vinaya Pitaka, just over 20 volumes maybe, yeah. So 20 volumes. Now, if you have the leaves in your hand compared to the leaves in the overhead, maybe one in 1,000, yeah, at the most, maybe even less than that. So we have 1,000 times as many books. Instead of having 20 volumes, we have 20,000 volumes. Imagine if you have to read 20,000 volumes. Yeah, that's when you start to understand, oh, I'm so happy the Buddha only taught us the essentials. That's too much reading. So this is the problem with the human mind. When I ask you, wouldn't that be interesting? Think, yeah, that would be really interesting. I think the same. Yeah, that would be really interesting to read what the Buddha really saw out there, because he always had some real insight. But that's the problem. The problem is that it is so interesting. Yeah. You would get lost in philosophy, get lost in speculation about the world, get lost in all kinds of things. And then because it doesn't fit with our modern view, you start arguing with the Buddha. It doesn't fit with quantum mechanics. That's what Singh Chao would say. Yeah, it doesn't fit with quantum mechanics. Yeah, whatever it is. And then we start arguing with him, and you lose completely the plot as to what actually is important. The problem is precisely that it's too interesting. Already, we're doing precisely that with the suttas. Already, we're trying to pull out kind of bits of information about the universe, about all these kind of things. The reason those things are in the suttas now is basically because they are incidental knowledge in the suttas. They're not core part of the Dhamma at all. And that's why it is there. Yeah, so I probably shouldn't have done this, probably it was a crazy idea. I wrote a little pamphlet about Buddhist cosmology or the Buddhist universe recently based on the suttas. Probably that was wrong, yeah. I'm just reading this now. I think, jeepers, why did I do that for? Actually, no, I did. I did do it in quite a nice way, because I said in there, actually, all of this is really irrelevant, I said at the end. Yeah? So forget about everything I've said. Throw out this book, yeah, that you've just read. No, but you have to pull the Dhamma out of things. And when you pull the Dhamma out of these things, when you understand why the Buddha taught this, then it is acceptable. But basically, all of this cosmology stuff, all of these things in the world, there's too much of it. And what is interesting is that, when after the Buddha passed away, then soon after that we started to get new scriptures coming into existence. Some of the scriptures started to come out soon after the Buddha passed away, with the Jataka stories, for example. And they sort of became semi-canonical after a while. But one of the other things that started to happen soon after the Buddha passed away was the Abhidhamma started to develop. The Abhidhamma was something that came mostly after the Buddha. What is the Abhidhamma? Well, the Abhidhamma is really philosophy. Yeah, that's what it is. It is philosophy. It is trying to understand the world fully, completely. The purpose of the Abhidhamma is to kind of take out the teachings of the Buddha and say, well, actually, the teachings of the Buddha, they have a few gaps. They don't really give us a full explanation of the world. Let's make a full explanation of the world. Then that is how you basically get the Abhidhamma. You divide it up into tiny atomic units. Yeah, the mind can be have so many different types of mind. You can have these types of matter that interact in this particular way. And that is how the Abhidhamma came to exist. So the Abhidhamma is precisely those leaves up there. Yeah, that's the Abhidhamma. The Buddha said we shouldn't worry about those. Actually, the Abhidhamma probably isn't even those leaves, because those leaves up there is what the Buddha knew, but the Abhidhamma is adding speculation to what the Buddha knew as well. So remember that. Abhidhamma is basically philosophy. It is those things that are outside of what is required. The Buddha says many places, I have taught you all that is required. These teachings are complete. Yeah, they are fulfilled. They are paripunna. Paripunna means complete. Parisuddha means pure. This is enough. if you go outside of this, you start to go into an area where actually you will lose out because you start doing these things. So if people ask me, should I learn Abhidhamma? I would say, no, forget about the Abhidhamma. Why? Because it just drags you into this whole area of philosophy. I apologize to the BJP because I know that you have Abhidhamma classes here. And you see, I know already, yeah? So I'm not. But I said, don't worry about the Abhidhamma. There is enough to read already in the suttas. How many of you have actually read the four Nikayas already here? Wei Yin, have you read? Not even Wei Yin, yeah? I mean, that's amazing. So this is kind of, yeah, we haven't even read the whole word of the Buddha, and yet we already get sidetracked into philosophy and this kind of speculation. So. Yeah. You want to use the microphone? Yeah. Yeah.
But the Abhidhamma is the third basket of the Pali Canon. The
correct.
First is you have Pitaka, Vinaya Pitaka,
yeah.
And then Abhidhamma Pitaka.
Yeah.
The third basket.
Yes.
So why is it not encouraged to read or to know or to study the Abhidhamma?
Okay. The reason is because the Pali Canon is not the same as the word of the Buddha. Yeah? And this is kind of the point here. The point here, the Buddha says, what I have taught is Dhamma and Vinaya. That is what you should pass into the future. What did the Buddha teach as Dhamma and Vinaya? It does not include the Abhidhamma. It does not include all the Sutta Pitaka. Remember I said the four main Nikayas, yeah? Digha Nikaya, Majjha Nikaya, Sanyutta, Anguttara Nikaya. But there's much more in the Sutta Pitaka than that. And a lot of that is much, much later than the early suttas. Yeah, it got nothing to do with the word of the Buddha. If you read some of these texts, you think, what is this? It sounds like a different religion. Yeah, that's what it sounds like. It's so different from the word of the Buddha. So, we have to be careful. Just because something is called the Tripitaka or the Tipitaka does not mean that it is the word of the Buddha. The only way you can know something is the word of the Buddha is that you have to study these things very carefully on linguistic grounds. What kind of language is used? Yeah? On doctrinal grounds, what kind of teachings are given in these kind of things? On the grounds of what, you know, how the environment that is talked about, and all of these kind of things. And when you use strict criteria like that for deciding what is early and what is late, it becomes quite clear that the four main Nikayas, that is early Buddhism. Some of the Vinaya is early Buddhism. That is what we can rely on as the word of the Buddha. Yeah. So the fact Tipitaka is not really, Tipitaka is just a container. Then you have, open up the container and look, well, which part of this is the word of the Buddha, which is not. It doesn't automatically give it the stamp of approval.
So in other words, Ajahn is saying that Sutta Pitaka and Suttanta are different, is it? Suttas are different. Sutta Pitaka and Suttas, the four Nikaya, they are totally different, are they?
What happened is that, you know, some of the suttas, they started to collect the suttas early on, yeah? And the monks would kind of recite the suttas at the first council and all these kind of things. And then after the Buddha passed away, they continued to add more things after the Buddha passed away. And some of those things were added a long, long, long time after the Buddha, centuries after the Buddha. Like things like the Buddha Vangsa, Charya Pitaka, is all part of the Sutta Pitaka, yeah? Appadana, I mean, most people have never even heard about these scriptures before, let alone read them. But there's hardly an English translation of these things available because it's so obscure. But it's part of the Sutta Pitaka. There is the Nidesa, excuse me. The Nidesa is a commentarial work that is a commentary on two of the chapters in the Sutta Nipata. If you read it, you'll be bored out of your eyes because it's so boring to read it. You think, what is this? It's got nothing to do with the word of the Buddha. When you start reading these things, you realize it's a completely different text.
So what we are studying now from the four Nikayas, you're talking is about the early doctrines of the Buddha?
These are the teachings of the Buddha, yeah.
The early doctrines of the Buddha.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That is the important point there, yeah. And this is, if you look at, you know, kind of contemporary scholarship into these things, everybody pretty much agrees that this is the case. You know, the Abhidhamma is a later addition, yeah. So of course, if you ask a Theravadan monk, yeah, they might say it's the word of the Buddha. But very often that is because this is what they have been taught by their teachers and the pastors. And they haven't really looked at it in a historical context. This is part of the problem. So you have to, just because some monk says this is the word of the Buddha, it's not because they are lying or anything like that. It's just that this is the traditional view of these things that have been handed down. Yeah. Yeah, please. Yeah.
Ajahn, soon it will be Qingming, the Chinese tradition of tomb sweeping.
Uh-huh.
I'll be observing it with my family next week.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Is it stated in the four Nikayas anywhere about, I think the word is Ulambana or something like that, related to filial piety, Mogalana. I remember some story about it, paying respect to our departed ones.
Yeah.
It's coming in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
What do you do?
In China it's very popular.
Yeah.
It's something my mom taught me, and something that her parents and grandparents taught her.
Yeah.
We go to the tomb, we will clear it, and we put joss sticks.
Yeah.
And at one time
before
I learned about Buddhism, I also helped my mom to we offer food, fruits, veg.
Yeah.
After that we will eat the food also.
Okay.
But as time passed on, like now my brother's children, they do not like all this. Burning a lot of those paper money.
Oh yeah.
And my sister in law even burned a pair of maids for my parents who have departed already.
Yeah.
So I like to know about this practice. It's very traditional. It's a lot to do with Chinese customs. But I think also related to Confucianism, the thing about filial piety, respecting our ancestors.
Okay. Well, I mean, filial piety is important, you know, and I think in all societies, filial piety is important, and maybe probably more important than Chinese society, but in all societies, these are important, and certainly Buddhist culture, also very important. So it's just a matter of how we do it. How do we have filial piety? And it's doing it in a way which is as constructive as possible. This is part of your tradition. If you do, nothing is really, nothing, you're not doing anything bad, as long as you don't kill the chickens or whatever anymore. You haven't done anything bad. So it's if that is part of the family tradition and you feel that, you know, other people in your family want to do it or whatever, you can do it. But I don't think it is very important. More important to do some acts of kindness on behalf of your departed family. Yeah, do some acts of merit. Offer something somewhere. Give something to charity. Give something to poor. Give something to a Buddhist cause. Yeah, and then say that I'm doing this on behalf of, you know, of my parents or the departed. And there's actually a sutta, a very nice sutta, where the Buddha talks to a Brahmin called Janusoni. And Janusoni asks the Buddha, well, is it true that my departed relatives can actually get some results out of acts of merit and generosity? And the Buddha said, yes, they can. Depends on where they have been reborn. If they have been reborn in the Peta Loka, the Loka of departed spirits, then they can actually receive some of these things. So it depends on where they've been reborn. Janusoni said, well, but what if my family members, what if I don't have any family members in the Peta Loka? And the Buddha says, In this long samsara, guaranteed that you have some family members in Peta Loka, yeah? Been going on for so long, round and round and round, so absolutely guaranteed. So your offering is never wasted, yeah? If you do something on behalf of somebody else, it's never actually wasted. So think about your parents in that way instead. I think that's more powerful. Do an act of charity, do an act of kindness in that way. If you see your parents and wish them some metta, some loving kindness, send some kind thoughts to them. If they are still connected to you, they may still be able to feel what you think as well to some extent. Yeah. So if you send them some, wish them well wherever they are, it may make them feel happy. I think this is more important. I have nothing against these ancient, you know, rituals myself. It's fine. You can do them if you wish, you know. But maybe it has a little bit of effect. Maybe your parents kind of look down and say, wow, look at my daughter, she's kind of looking after us. Maybe. So it's possible. I don't think it is. If your children or the younger generation are not interested, I think that's okay as well. You know, I don't think you have to be too concerned about that. it's really, you know, traditions change, so yeah. Okay, let me just finish off this particular sutta. So this is all the things the Buddha has not taught. So what has he taught? And this is what he has taught. I have taught this is suffering. I have taught this is the origin of suffering. I have taught this is the end of suffering. I have taught this is the way leading to the end of suffering. And why, bhikkhus, have I taught this? Because this is beneficial, relevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life, and it leads to revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to nibbana. Therefore, I have taught this. So it is only those things that have a practical effect that the Buddha has taught. He is only concerned with things that actually work in this life. Everything else he throws out. Focus on the core things. And still we have 20 volumes of teachings, even though we focus just on the actual core things. And in this case you can see here, in a sense you could argue that here the Four Noble Truths are what summarizes the Dhamma. Before I said the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, but here the Four Noble Truths are really the summary of his teachings. And because there is always going to have to be some theoretical aspect to include in the path. What happens when you know these Four Noble Truths? What do they lead to? Well, they are beneficial, relevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life. In other words, they encourage you on the path, they lead you forward. And eventually, if you practice these things in the right way, they lead to all these beautiful results. And you may wonder perhaps if revulsion is beautiful or not. It sounds like a kind of hard word. Revulsion means like being repelled, but this is kind of the point of the Buddha, is that when you understand things in the right way, then you are repelled by those things that are suffering in the world. And you become dispassionate towards that. You no longer have any craving and desire for it. The craving and desire ceases. And because of that, it leads to peace. It leads to direct knowledge, in other words, direct insight into the nature of reality. To awakening, to the lights going on inside your mind. Wow! This is what it's like. Jeepers! Well, I've been messing around for so long. To nibbana, to extinguishment, to the extinguishment of the kilesas, of the defilements of the heart. That is what it leads to. It leads to all these wonderful things that the Buddha promises us. It may seem to you that these things are perhaps not so wonderful. Cessation, what's so wonderful about cessation? Yeah. Okay, nibbana, okay, I don't know what nibbana is anyway. Awakening, far away from me. Direct knowledge, I don't know what that is. Peace, okay, peace sounds fair enough. Revolt, not sure if I want to be all that revolted. Doesn't sound so good. So perhaps all this looks a bit kind of academic to you and kind of far away. But remember, this is the Buddha speaking. When the Buddha speaks, he often sometimes uses language that is kind of related to the noble ones on the Buddhist path. Those people who have really profound understandings of things. It's a very high vantage point that the Buddha looks from. It's like being an eagle with the eagle's eye looking down, seeing the whole landscape. So when we look at this, remember that all of these things, they also have a complementary side to them. All of this means happiness. Yeah? All of this means joy. This means metta. It means karuna, compassion. It means wisdom. The positive side is also there, even though there is a kind of negative slant on this. And that always comes together with that. So if you ever see anyone who you think might be a little bit enlightened, you will normally find that they are more happy here. They are more balanced. They are more kind of at ease than almost anyone else in the world. And that is how you know that they actually have those good qualities. They don't kind of become completely stiff, robotic, revolted by everything. Oh, yuck. They're not like that. They have a very powerful human qualities. And that is how you know that someone has gone a long way on the Buddhist path. So remember, it's always the positive side. People often talk about the Four Noble Truths and say, oh, so negative. Well, it's just because it comes from the Buddha. It is very profound. Actually, the Four Noble Truths have the positive side to them. happiness. Yeah, the source of happiness, the path leading to happiness, is really the positive side of the Four Noble Truths. So remember, what we want to do is we want to look at those leaves that are important. Dependent origination fits into those leaves, yeah, that are important, that are required for our proper understanding of the Buddhist path. And this is why this afternoon, when you come back, brace yourself for dependent origination. Don't eat too much for lunch, yeah? If you eat too much, you're going to come back, you're going to be snoring. I'm going to look at you all. You're going to sit in there nodding ahead, not nodding away. Don't be afraid. You can eat a lot this evening when you come back for dinner. This lunch, because otherwise, dependent origination is going to pass you by, and you're going to be wondering what happened. And you're going to So I'm just joking. Just eat whatever you like. I don't really mind. If you fall asleep, you're welcome to fall asleep. If you snore, we will have compassion for you, and we will say, well done, yeah, that you're snoring in here. Anyway, enough for now, and let us just have a nice lunch together, and we'll see you back again at 2 o'clock, Bob, is that right? What time is it? 2 o'clock? Yeah? Yes? Okay. So we'll see you back again at 2 o'clock.